Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 316 of the True Crime All the Time podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
I'm doing good, man. How about you?
I'm doing very well. Much better.
Good.
I'm on, like, week three, and even though there's still a little bit lingering, I feel so much better.
It's always a good sign.
It is. It is. Let's go ahead and give our Patreon shout-outs. We had Lisa Sharphorn.
What's going on, Lisa?
Krista Wexall.
Hey, Krista.
Charlene.
Hey, appreciate that, Charlene.
Shayla Hayward.
What's going on, Shayla?
Tracy Nail.
Hey, Tracy.
Faith Aguilar.
Well, appreciate that, Faith.
Gina Marion.
Oh, good old Gina.
Justin Keller.
Hey, Justin.
Miss Elise.
Well, thank you, Miss.
Tiffany Ford.
Hey, Tiffany.
Sandy Bingman.
Hi, Sandy.
Melissa Kennedy jumped down to our highest level.
Man, thank you so much, Melissa.
We had Heather Kraft.
What's up, Heather?
Erica Williams.
Hey, Erica.
Daniel Holztrager.
Holztrager.
Lupe.
What's going on, Lupe?
Jamie Brown.
Hey, Jamie.
Jamie Phillips jumped out to our highest level.
That's awesome, Jamie.
And last but not least, Susanna Pemberton.
Well, thank you so much, Susanna.
Yeah, we appreciate the new support. And then if we go back into the vault, this week we selected Colleen Butcher.
Oh, that's awesome, Colleen.
It is. We appreciate the new support, the continued support. We had some amazing PayPal donations. Alice Yang sent what I believe is the biggest PayPal donation ever.
Well, that's awesome. And love that.
Yeah, we also had big donations from Erica Grenier.
Well, thank you, Erica.
And Keir Vernon.
I never heard that name, Keir.
Keir. It's kind of cool. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but I like it. Gibbs, right now on Unsolved, we have part two and the final part on the murder of Betty Gore and the case against Candy Montgomery. You know, a very interesting story, one that people have been asking us to do for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
Part two is really good. So make sure you check that out.
Definitely one you have to listen to.
Crime Con's coming up, I think, in September. If you're going and you're going to buy your tickets, go to crimecon.com. Use our promo code TCAT, T-C-A-T-T. That'll get you 10% off your standard badge price. All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time?
I'm ready.
We are talking about a man named T. Eugene Thompson. Kind of a strange name.
It is strange.
T stands for Tilmer, which I had never heard before either. But we've got a lot going on. We've got, you know, murder for hire plots, affairs, conspirators, all in an effort to gain some life insurance.
That's a lot of activity.
It is. It is. So let's get right into it. Tilmer Eugene Thompson was born on August 7th, 1927. He was born in Elmore, Minnesota. That's according to his Find a Grave profile. There was a 2015 New York Times article that said he was born in Blue Earth, Minnesota.
It's Minnesota.
I don't actually know where either one of those is, but safe to say he was born in Minnesota.
Minnesota.
He was the son of a chicken farmer.
And it was said that he grew up in Elmore near the Iowa border. T. Eugene was given the nickname Cotton because apparently he had like that whitish blonde hair.
I had that when I was young.
Did you?
Yeah, I sure did.
I can picture that.
Yeah.
I can picture that. You probably wish you had the density of it back. I know I do.
You had to go there, huh?
Well, yours is nowhere near where mine is, son. You've got a pretty full head of hair. I'm just saying, I'm sure you wish it was a little denser. I'm saying I wish I had
just the
first two-thirds of mine back from the front back.
I still can't believe no one's invented something to like make hair growth.
Like a chia pet type situation.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff. I'm not taking those ones from the back, though, and having them implanted in the front. T. Eugene played football with future Senator and Vice President Walter Mondale. So Mondale was VP during Jimmy Carter's presidency. According to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, Mondale said about T. Eugene, "We grew up together. His family lived just a block from mine. His dad was in the poultry business. It was really painful for me when he got into severe trouble with the law. He did something for which there was no excuse. He had to pay that price, and he did. He's got a nice family. I feel sorry for them, and I extend my deepest sympathies to them." So this is a little different.
Sure, it is.
How many people do we talk about on True Crime all the time where, you know, a vice president, senator, somebody really high up in the government was friends with this guy and has to come out and say, right, you know, things to the press?
I don't condone what he did, but we were friends at one point.
Well, I would hope he say, I don't condone what he did. That'd be front page news if he went a different direction. So T. Eugene dropped out of high school to enlist in the Navy. The Twin Cities Pioneer Press reported that he lied about his age. And apparently he served in World War II on a minesweeper in the Pacific.
I think a lot of kids back then lied about their age because they wanted to go into the service.
Yeah. Yeah, they wanted to serve their country. After the war, he attended college in St. Paul, Minnesota from 1946 to 1950. He then went on to St. Paul College of Law and was there from 1951 to 1955. That's what it was called back then. I saw where now it's called William Mitchell College of Law. So T. Eugene was admitted to the bar in 1955. He worked several jobs and then started practicing law. So he worked in personal injury, domestic relations, and criminal law. At the time of his arrest, he was the chairman of the Criminal Law Committee of the Minnesota State Bar Association. This was a guy who was active in bar association activities and even taught some at the William Mitchell College of Law.
Yeah, so he had a good educational and sounds like professional life because he went from high school dropping out, joined the Navy, and must eventually got his either his GED or something while he was in the Navy to go to college and worked his way up through law school. And you have to commend him for that.
Yeah, you give people their props for... Yeah. That part, obviously, his life's going to turn in a bad direction. We know that, or he wouldn't be the subject of this episode. T. Eugene met his wife, Carol, at college. Carol Ann Swoboda Thompson was born on October 11th, 1928, in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was the only child of a local business owner. The two got married on March 27th, 1948. Carol and T. Eugene had a son named Jeffrey and three daughters named Margaret, Amy, and Patricia. The children were born in 1949, 1951, 1953, and 1956.
It was a very busy 7 years.
Four kids in 7 years. That is a lot of diaper changes. That's a lot of feedings. That's just a lot of work, period. The family moved into their St. Paul home in 1958. So they lived in this Highland Park neighborhood of St. Paul, Minnesota, which was described as a pretty upscale neighborhood.
Kind of swanky.
Swanky, upscale. I think you could use a number of adjectives. Carol and T were active in their community. and the Edgecombe Presbyterian Church. I'm having a trouble saying T. Eugene all the time, so I may mix it up a little bit. It's just strange. T. Eugene.
It really is.
But
just go with T, man.
T. I might just go T.
Yeah.
Carol was once president of the church's women's association. She taught kindergarten there, and she sang in the choir. She also led a Girl Scout troop. T. was an elder and trustee of the church. In court documents, it said, so far as the record shows, their married life was harmonious, and they seemed to get along well together, taking many trips with each other. According to the New York Times, the Thompson family were pillars of the community.
It's always a lot of pressure to be the pillars of the community.
Yeah, I know. Really, I know it's something you struggle with in your pillar role, but it's also something we've talked about many times in episodes, which is, you know, whether it's a facade or not, you have this family that from the outside looking in seems like, wow, they've got it all, right? The kids, good jobs, the money, living in the upscale neighborhood, yeah. Nice house.
Right.
But somebody in that family's got maybe a dark side, or eventually something bad is going to happen. According to court documents, in the summer of 1960, T. Eugene commenced a social relationship with a woman named Jacqueline Okoneski. Apparently, this was a woman that he represented in a divorce action. They started this relationship, and it continued until December 1961. They went on dinner dates. He visited her apartment. They went to out-of-state motels, went on trips to a house in Forest Lake, owned by Carol's father, and even went on a trip to Chicago. So this was an affair. Sounds like an affair.
Sounds like an affair to me.
In 1961, Jacqueline went to business school, and she paid her tuition and expenses with money borrowed from T. Eugene. I guess he employed her as a secretary after she graduated, and ultimately she did repay the money she borrowed.
Okay.
But in December of 1961, Jackie started dating a man named Ronald Oleson. In early 62, she returned a ring that T had given her before she started dating Ronald. And it was in January of that year that she ended her employment at T. Eugene's law firm.
Sounds like at that point, she was definitely done with T.
Yeah, but in the research, it said after December 1961, they dated a few times. But only a few times, and she started to indicate to T. Eugene that she was interested in marrying this guy, Oleson. Jackie later testified that in February 1962, T. Eugene asked her if she would give him a year or 11 months to get his financial affairs straightened around so as to arrange for the financial well-being of his family. But she refused.
Seems strange to say, can you give me a year or 11 months? Just, why not just
a year?
You know, say a year.
11 or 12 months or... But what do you make of that? I need to get my financial affairs straightened for the financial well-being of my family. Well, I understand what that means, but what does Jackie have to do with it?
Well, yeah, nothing, you know? I mean, he's trying to hold on to her. He doesn't want to lose her.
Right, so he's basically saying...
I'll do this for you.
Yes. And, you know, obviously we'll get into it, but what does that mean when I say, you know, when he says I'm going to get my financial affairs in order, just give me a little more time. Yeah.
But clearly she's not interested.
No, she wasn't. After early 1962, she only saw him a few times and said it was only for business purposes. In June of 62, Jackie married Ronald Oleson. Later that summer, though, she came to T. Eugene's office to discuss getting a divorce from Ronald, and papers were drawn to start a divorce action.
That didn't last very long.
No, obviously, maybe it wasn't as good as what they or she thought it was going to be. Maybe he wasn't the man that she thought he was. Jackie said she had lunch with T. Eugene in the summer of 1962. He asked if she would marry him if he put $10,000 in the bank in her name. She said no.
Yeah, that's a really strange way to ask somebody to marry you. I want you to marry me, and if you do, I'm going to put $10,000 in your bank account.
a little less romantic than, you know, the ring in the champagne glass.
Yeah.
That someone finds as they start to drink it or get to the bottom of it.
Maybe that works sometimes. I can't see how a marriage like that would survive based on
a financial proposition.
Exactly.
In September 1962, T. Eugene commenced Jackie's divorce action. He served Ronald Oleson the papers. In October of that year, they contemplated a reconciliation. T. requested that one of Jackie's friends discourage her from this reconciliation. But by November 1962, Jackie and Ronald reconciled and they were back living together.
I'm sure T. didn't like that.
No, I don't think he did. He called Jackie a few times. Court documents indicate that in December of 62, he had some what were termed harsh words with Ronald. And basically, Ronald would not allow him to talk to Jackie. Jackie testified that sometime after Christmas of 62, T. Eugene called her at work and asked if she'd be interested in taking an apartment in a building he owned. She said no. And this seems to be the last time that he contacted Jackie before Carol's death, which obviously we're getting ready to get into. But I think from what we've talked about so far, it's pretty easy to see that T was enamored. He was in love with Jackie.
Oh, for sure. You can tell.
He wanted to be with her.
Wanted to kind of control her too, I think. Her either by, I'll pay you to be with me, or can you move into one of my apartments just so I can keep tabs on you?
Yeah, I got that as well. There was maybe multiple attempts to try to figure out a way to control her or to get her indebted to him, maybe as part of the control process. So now we have to go back to early 1962. This is January. T. Eugene and Carol traveled to Chicago, and they visited the home of Mr. and Mrs. Bruce Gove. This is a couple that they had known since college. Bruce was an insurance salesman, and he urged T. to buy life insurance for Carol after he learned that she didn't really have much. He recommended a $50,000 policy. But when they got back to St. Paul, T. talked to his insurance agent, a guy by the name of James Traynor, about term insurance. And he ended up purchasing not one, but several insurance policies. Much of it was term insurance with accidental death benefits or what was termed purely accidental death insurance.
Okay. He's kind of putting some writing on the wall there, maybe.
Well, so, I mean, I know that a lot of term policies have maybe an extra payout for accidental death. What I've never had, and I've actually never seen, is a policy that only pays out in the event of an accidental death. My thought is you could get a lot more coverage for a lot less money if it only pays out in this one scenario. But to your point, if your wife then ends up dying accidentally, and I'm using my air quotes here, it's going to put a little bit of a target on you.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Well, and she had a pretty big target on her.
In the form of the life insurance policies that he took out?
Yeah,
it was over $1 million in total. 62, Gibbs, use that big brain and calculate what would that be in today's money?
Probably close to $4 million.
I think it's a lot more.
Yeah. Thinking seven?
I think it's over double digits.
Wow.
If I had to guess.
Yeah.
I really do. Now, I'm not as good at it as you are.
Well.
But I'm going, 12. That's my guesstimate.
That's a lot of money today. That's a hell of a lot of money back then. You're thinking it would be the same amount of money.
It would be the exact same amount of money. I mean, it's different amounts, but it's worth the same. So I'm not sure if that came out exactly the way you meant it to, but let's roll with it.
Yeah.
And we'll just go past it. So apparently T. Eugene told this Traynor guy and later testified himself that he wanted this much insurance because if he died first, Carol and the kids would have about $1 million by combining his life insurance, which was just shy of $500,000, and then $500,000 inheritance from Carol's father. And he was pretty wealthy. He was a wealthy plumbing contractor. T. Eugene later testified that he purchased the insurance so he and the kids would have an equal amount if Carol died first. And he also said that he could easily afford the insurance out of an unneeded monthly retainer he got from the company owned by Carol's father. T. Eugene also said that he had a premonition that Carol would have a tragic accident on February 8th or 9th, 1963, in that he'd had similar premonitions when his brother and sister died unexpectedly. Okay, we got to talk about this.
Like, what, a clairvoyant?
Well, you know, people have bad dreams. People have bad thoughts or bad feelings that maybe something is going to happen.
Right.
I've had some of those. I have never had anything where I thought someone is going to die, and I can tell you the date. That is very creepy.
It's really creepy. You can tell me when I'm going to die, but you can't tell me how to win the $1 billion lottery that's coming up.
I know. These things work in strange ways, I guess. In July of 1962, a guy by the name of Norman Mastrian, a former prize fighter from Twin Cities, contacted T. Eugene about a possible false arrest. These guys had attended college together, but apparently T didn't remember this guy. But on July 31st of that year, he agreed to represent Mastrian if he was paid a $2,500 retainer. Now, Mastrian didn't have this much money, but he did own stock in a corporation called Telestat. And T. Eugene agreed to take 1,000 shares instead of the retainer. But apparently the company refused to make the transfer this way, so
they commit a little stock fraud?
Well, it sounds like it, right? So T. Eugene paid this guy $2,500 in cash.
In return for the stock.
But then he took the money back and the stock.
Yeah.
So it was a little strange the way that it sounded. And then he ended up buying the remaining shares that this guy owned. And in total, I think he paid like $2,700 or something like that. He later testified that he wanted to acquire a controlling interest in this company. But on December 31st, 1962, he figured out that the stock was virtually worthless, and he sold it all to the company president for $800.
That's a pretty healthy loss.
Yeah, you're going to have to write that off for sure. You know, springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at Simply Safe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. Springtime also means more time outside and away from home. And I trust Simply Safe. I love the myriad of features that they offer. And I love the price. Simply Safe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. The system blankets your whole home in protection. There are so many sensors, from detecting break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, they have a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day, so you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. There's no contract, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you can try Simply Safe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. Simply Safe has given Gibby and I and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new Simply Safe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplysafe.com/TCAT. That's simplysafe.com/TCATT. There's no safe like Simply Safe. True crime all the time is sponsored by BetterHelp.
I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. So from August 62 to February 63, T. Eugene met Mastrian in different places, and they talked on the phone a bunch. He was representing this guy in several different legal matters at the time. T. Eugene hired Norman Mastrian to kill his wife, Carol, for $3,000. The New York Times reported that he wanted Mastrian to bludgeon Carol with a rubber hose, put her in the bathtub, and stage an accidental drowning.
It's the rubber hose used to make sure that there's no
marks. That's my thought.
Yeah.
Because if not, you would use something a little more substantial. According to Bill Swanson, author of Dial M, The Murder of Carol Thompson, T. Eugene hired Mastrian because he was a former client. Swanson told the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, Norman Mastrian was a guy who was known to police, in and out of trouble. He had been involved in the murder of an underworld type years earlier, and T. Eugene had been involved in his defense. So, you know, I take from that T kind of knew what this guy was all about, knew some of the things that maybe he'd been into in the past, and at least had a good idea that maybe he would be open to, you know, some type of murder for hire plot. Because, you know, you and I talk about that all the time. How do you go to somebody and say, hey, will you kill my wife for $3,000? You know, a friend, an acquaintance. I think that would be pretty tough. People do it all the time. They get caught. But here's a guy who had kind of maybe done some shady things in the past. And so he felt a little more comfortable maybe going to this guy.
Just seems like a really low number.
It always does, right? What number wouldn't seem low, number one, to have your wife killed? And then number two, as the person taking the money to take a human life for X amount of dollars.
And all that risk that goes with it.
Well, not only the risk, but to me, I always think of like the stain on your soul. You know, money's not going to wipe that away. That knowledge that you took somebody's life and something that you really got to live with for the rest of yours. On January 24th, 1963, T. Eugene took the family dog to the vet and asked the vet to rehome the dog. I didn't know that's something that a vet would do, but maybe back in the 60s it was. But here's the thing. He claimed that they had installed new carpet and the dog had stained their old carpet. And because they couldn't train her, they felt like they had to get rid of her. Now, one important thing in the research was that this dog barked whenever someone came to the house. That's important. It's also important that it's disputed whether or not Carol knew why T. Eugene was giving the dog away or if she was okay with it at all. But obviously it's going to come up, right, as part of the case. The family's phone was often kept in the upstairs bedroom, but it was taken out of the house on March 4th, 1963,
T. Eugene claimed that they got rid of it because they wanted to get a new phone that would match their home decor. The phone would later be found in his car after Carol was killed. So in late February 1963, Norman Mastrian started looking for someone to commit the murder for hire. A man named Sheldon Morris testified that he was present when Mastrian asked a man named Richard Sharp if he would do it for $2,000. Sharp said he wasn't interested, but knew a man named Bill Ingram who might do it. Morris was also present when Mastrian asked Ingram if he would kill a woman for $2,000. Ingram said he wasn't interested. So there's a couple of things here. First of all, Norman's getting $3,000.
Right.
And he's looking to subcontract the hit for $2,000. He pockets $1,000. But he's already asked two people, and those two people both turned him down. And I think, you know, back to your point, when you start just looking for people to kill someone else, you are leaving a trail all over the place.
You really are.
Because when someone ends up dead, now they may not know the name of the person you wanted killed, but if there's any connection to you whatsoever, it's not going to be that hard for them to figure out that, well, he must have found somebody to do it.
Yeah. I just, how do you know so many people?
Well, and then, you know, the first guy, Richard Sharp, says, you know what? I don't really want to do it, but I know a guy who might.
Yeah.
And that's so strange. How do you even know a guy who might want to do it?
How does those conversations come around, you know?
The guy says, hey, if anybody ever says anything about it, make sure you contact me. I'm up for it.
Yeah. Just let me know.
Morris testified that on March 2nd, Mastrian asked a man named Henry Butler if he would kill a woman, but Butler said no.
Good answer.
So here's guy number three. Morris testified that on the morning of March 4th, Mastrian told him he had to meet T. Eugene at a pancake house in St. Paul. Mastrian borrowed his car that evening for the meeting in the parking lot behind McGuire's restaurant. Richard Sharp testified at trial that he was offered a job by Mastrian to kill a church-going woman with four children. And he said Mastrian suggested that the murder should be done by hitting the woman with a rubber hose and drowning her in the bathtub.
Trying to keep it clean that way, I guess.
Sharp said he was told the price was $2,000, but if it looked like an accident, it would be $3,000. He testified that on or about March 2nd, he introduced Mastrian to a guy named Dick Anderson. Dick Anderson was described as a troubled Korean War combat veteran and an ex-convict from Michigan. This is what the Twin Cities Pioneer Press wrote about him. He also worked as a roofing salesman. Sharp claimed he was present on March 3rd when Mastrian offered the job to Anderson. Anderson said he'd think about it. So not a flat out no this time.
Right.
Let me think about it. Sharp testified that on March 4th, he gave the gun to Mastrian that was used during the attack on Carol Thompson. So, you know, I think I said up front, there's a lot of conspirators involved in this situation. And already, you know, we're hearing about a lot of them.
Yeah, we've got a few layers here now.
Yeah, Mastrian is kind of tasked with getting the job done. Sharp doesn't want to do it, but he's putting Mastrian on to other people who might. And at one point, he supplied the gun that was ultimately used to kill Carol Thompson. So he's very involved, even though I'm not sure he's even getting paid.
Yeah, I don't think he probably is.
Because he turned down the job.
Yeah.
So what's he even involved for? According to court documents, Willard Ingram also testified and corroborated Morris and Sharp's statements. Henry Butler testified that Mastrian offered him the job, and that he was there when Mastrian gave the gun to Anderson. He also testified that on March 4th or March 5th, he heard Mastrian ask Anderson, "What happened today? I had a perfect alibi." So Dick Anderson testified that he met Mastrian on March 3rd, 1963. And that very same day, Mastrian asked him if he was interested in killing a woman. I mentioned it, right? Anderson said he'd think about it. I guess later that day, Mastrian called him, and Anderson said, "Yep, I'll do it." but he would need half the payment, $1,000, before he did the job. Mastrian agreed to meet him on March 4th and said he could only get $200, but he'd have the rest by next Friday. 34-year-old Carol Thompson was murdered by Dick Anderson on March 6th, 1963. So everything, right, was kind of leading up to this murder of Carol Thompson. I'm going to go back to Anderson. Finally, Mastrian finds a guy who says that he's willing to commit the murder. He wants half $1,000 up front. Well, you know what? I can only get 200. I get the rest to you later. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
He's still in.
Yep.
He's still in. And he ultimately kills this woman. It was March 6th, 1963. Seemed like a normal day. Carol cooked bacon and eggs for her husband and the kids. And then after making breakfast, she went back to bed. T. Eugene went to his office earlier than normal on March 6th. His secretary called home. She spoke to Carol. And then T. spoke with Carol and said he couldn't come home early in the afternoon like they had planned. Carol had no idea that her husband planned to have her killed. His plan was detailed in the Park Rapids Enterprise. He would go to work early that day. Carol would send the kids to school. Dick Anderson would be waiting in the basement of the house for a phone call from T. Eugene's office. When Carol answered the phone, which was near the top of the steps, Anderson would sneak up on her and hit her on the back of the head. And then when Carol was unconscious, he would carry her to the bathtub and stage a drowning. Now, I don't think we have to say this, but obviously the rubber hose, the no marks, the drowning, it's all key.
It is.
For the accidental death life insurance payout. But this plan did not work out. Per Anderson's later confession, on March 6th, he realized that the basement steps were creaky. And he worried that Carol was going to hear him. So around 9 a.m., he ambushed her in her bedroom. He hit her on the head with a piece of rubber hose, and then he attempted to stage a bathtub drowning. But when he went to clean himself up, Carol woke up. The New York Times reported that Anderson testified, "She managed to get out of the tub, so I knew I had trouble."
I would say, yes, you do at that moment.
Well, because what you thought was going to plan now has, you know, that's all thrown out the window. Because Carol tried to escape. She ran to the first floor. Anderson tried to shoot her. But apparently, the pistol was loaded with the wrong ammo and it misfired. So he hit her in the head with the butt of a Luger pistol. And then he stabbed Carol in the neck with a paring knife, hard enough to break the handle. In total, Carol was stabbed over 50 times. Now, it's going to be real hard to claim an accidental death benefit.
Yeah, I think so. When you know that the victim died because they were stabbed over 50 times.
But even after all that, Carol managed to get away and run to a next door neighbor's house, but she didn't get any help there. She ran to another home, the home of Ruth Nelson. And it was said that Carol was so badly beaten that Ruth didn't even recognize her at first. The Star Tribune wrote that Carol told her, "I got a knife stuck in my throat. A man came to the door, and then she lost consciousness." So that's gruesome, but it really paints a pretty vivid picture of, you know, what this woman went through. This lady was a neighbor. Obviously, she knew who Carol was, but her face was so messed up that she didn't recognize her.
It'd be tough to see somebody in that condition at that moment.
No, absolutely. I mean, anyone, right? But then to find out that it's your neighbor, that would be extremely tough. Ruth Nelson and her son, Sydney, called for Dr. Fritz Pearson, a neighbor who was also a physician. He gave Carol first aid while they waited for the ambulance. According to the Star Tribune, Carol told him, "There is a knife in my throat." So it's the second time that she said that. Carol was taken to Anchor Hospital and surgeons removed a 3-inch knife blade from her throat. But Carol died at 12:58 p.m.
Well, obviously it wasn't enough to save her.
No, but you know, I mentioned that these knife blows were so hard that it ultimately broke off the handle. And so you have Carol saying, I've got a knife in my throat. I got a knife in my throat. Well, it turns out she did. There was a knife blade in her throat. The Ramsey County coroner said that Carol's death was caused by a skull fracture, brain hemorrhage, contusion of the brain, and 2 stab wounds to the neck. Carol also had 25 cuts on her head that were determined to be caused by a blunt object. Dick Anderson fled the scene. Around 9:15 a.m., one of Ruth Nelson's sons told T. Eugene that Carol was stabbed and was being taken to Anchor Hospital. T., an associate named Donald Kelly, went to Ruth Nelson's home. They saw that Carol had already been taken to the hospital, so then they went there. According to Lieutenant George Barkley, it seemed like Carol answered the door around 9 a.m. and was hit with a blunt instrument and knocked unconscious. She regained consciousness and crawled to the living room where she was attacked with a paring knife. She was hit on the head, face, and throat. Her windpipe was severed. The knife blade broke off in her throat. A bloody butcher knife was found in the kitchen. 3 unused 38 caliber pistol cartridges were found on the living room floor. They thought Carol may have been beaten with a pistol. At the time, it was reported that shotgun shells were found on the floor of another room. There were bloodstains on a sink upstairs, which indicated that the killer washed their hands. The upstairs rooms were ransacked, and the drawers were pulled out of the dressers. According to Barkley, the front room was splattered with blood, and furniture was out of place, which indicated that Carol fought with her killer. T. Eugene told the police he went to work after taking Jeffrey to school. The girls had already left. At the hospital, he suggested to the police that robbery could be a motive and suggested they look in the basement of his house to see if a large sum of money was stolen. So then he talked to the police later that day, and he showed them a briefcase that was in his office. Inside the briefcase were 44 $100 bills. So that works out to be $4,400. It's a lot of money in the early 60s, especially to be carrying around in cash.
It is. But just to step back for a minute, how horrific is it to hear everything that happened to her, Carol?
Yeah, it was a very brutal, nasty crime. And I think the police figured that out very quickly. What police did was they reviewed a list of T. Eugene's clients based on a theory they had that a disgruntled person killed Carol because of some grudge that they held against T. One neighbor reported seeing a man near the house on the morning of the 6th, but couldn't identify him. On March 8th, T. Eugene indicated that he wanted to withdraw $5,000 in cash from one of his accounts to hire private investigators, but he was advised by an associate that it wasn't a good idea to withdraw the money because of the questions about Carol's insurance policies. That same day, he talked to the police and said the hose found in the bathroom probably came from the lake house, but he had no idea why it was in the bathroom. After Carol's murder, there were rumors of a serial killer or some type of homicidal maniac on the loose in the community. The St. Paul police were under massive pressure to catch the killer.
Of course. I'm not surprised by that.
No, we see it a lot. But the thing is, T. Eugene was not a suspect at first. Police became suspicious of him when they learned that he had recently given away the family dog. I think that was kind of the first red flag. They were also suspicious of the fact that on the day of the murder, he got to work unusually early, and he asked his secretary to call Carol. So maybe red flags 2 and 3.
I think so.
But then detectives started receiving reports about the life insurance policies on Carol, over $1 million. They also got some reports that, you know, T. Eugene had a history of womanizing, but the entire time he denied being involved in the murder.
Yeah, but that's some pretty good motive there.
$1 million in the early 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think police have to look at it for sure.
You know, my wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
According to court documents, Sheldon Morris testified that 2 days later, he drove Norman Mastrian to Forest Lake, where Carol's father owned a cottage. They parked, waited for an hour, then went back to Minneapolis. They returned on March 9th and 10th. He testified that on March 15th, he delivered $800 from Mastrian to Dick Anderson with a message that this was all the money Mastrian could get at the time, and Anderson shouldn't bother him until Mastrian could make contact with the payoff man. So I don't think there's any doubt Anderson knew that this Mastrian was a middleman.
Yeah.
But I also think it's strange that you're hiring someone to commit a murder. And at first, you don't have even half the money, right? You give them $200, and then you come back with $800 later and say, you know what? Don't bother me for the rest of the money for a while, right? I think you're really kind of leaving yourself open there.
In a big way.
Not that this guy wants to tell because he's a murderer, but if the you-know-what hits the fan, you don't think he's going to, you know, make a plea, cop a deal, and testify about everything he knows?
If he's smart, he will.
On or around March 15th, attorney John Connolly gave Morris 25 $100 bills to give to Mastrian. On April 15th, Morris delivered an envelope from Mastrian to Anderson. The envelope was supposed to have $1,500 in it with a note that read, this was all the money Anderson could expect until Mastrian got money from the payoff man. Anderson informed Morris that he'd be gone for 2 weeks, and he wanted the rest of the money when he got back, or else.
The old or else.
Anytime you add or else at the end of something, it denotes something ominous, right? Something bad is going to happen. That's always the else. Yeah. It's never, I'm going to give you money or something good is going to happen to you. You better give me my money or else.
That's right.
Or else what? Or else I'll have to give you a gift. No, it doesn't work that way.
It's not something pleasant.
On March 20th, T. Eugene was contacted by attorney John Connolly, who was representing Mastrian, and was asked to bring some of Mastrian's files to the office. Okay, so the middleman in this murder for hire plot also has an attorney. T. Eugene gave Connolly 25 $100 bills and said that it was the return of the retainer that Mastrian gave him in connection with the matter in Anoka County. The Park Rapids Enterprise reported that the attorney would later tell police about this meeting and that there was no receipt of the transaction. On March 27th, Thompson released a statement confirming that he was the beneficiary of over $1 million in term and accident insurance. And I think, like you said earlier, that has to raise some eyebrows. Number one, you're the husband, so they're going to look at you anyway.
I think it's a big flag for me.
But when you've got that much money that you're going to get if your wife dies, and I get it, a lot of people have insurance, and maybe some people have massive amounts of insurance.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean anything bad is ever going to happen to the person, but if something did, you'd be looked at. That's all I'm saying.
If something happens to me, they're definitely going to be looking at you. It's weird that you took seven policies out on me,
mm-hmm.
but I just assume that, you know, you knew what you're doing.
It was also weird how easy it was. I might take seven more.
Yeah. You know, I don't know what you want it for, but you know, hey, whatever.
And you never will.
Well, because I won't be around when you collect.
To find out. On April 5th, the police said that parts of the gun handle found in the house came from a Luger pistol used to kill Carol. On April 9th, a man named Wayne Brandt identified the gun handle pieces as those from his Luger, which was stolen from his apartment in February. On April 17th, two men, Henry Butler and Willard Ingram, admitted to the police that they took the Luger and sold it to Norman Mastrian and Sheldon Morris. So again, we're hearing names that we've heard before, right? Willard Ingram was a person who was approached to commit the hit. And maybe Henry Butler was too. I can't remember. There's so many different people that, you know, Mastrian reached out to try to line up this hit. But all of this is pointing back to a couple of individuals. Mastrian was arrested at his home in Spring Lake Park on April 19th, 1963, and charged with first-degree murder. Later that day, Anderson and Richard Sharp were arrested in Phoenix, Arizona. And Dick Anderson confessed to the murder, but he also named Norman Mastrian as the middleman who hired him to kill Carol and said that T. Eugene Thompson was the mastermind behind the whole thing. Anderson confessed that he killed Carol for $2,300, which suggested that Norman Mastrian intended to keep $700. Right? Remember, we said Mastrian was going to get $300.
Right.
At first, he was trying to get somebody to do it for $2,000. It sounds like he ended up getting Anderson to do it for $2,300. He keeps $700. Now, we talk a lot about the amount of money that people kill for.
Right. Or lack of money.
Or, you know, how small it is, really. Right. Now, let's talk about a man who, for $700, middlemaned, to use that as a verb, probably incorrectly, this entire thing. He set up this murder.
Yeah.
He didn't pull the trigger, but he set it up, put everything in motion for $700.
Scary, really, if you think about it. It's such a little amount of money. For everything that he did and the fact that he did it and he knew that somebody was going
to
die.
Well, that's what I was going to say. He knew. He even went to people and said, hey, would you be willing to kill a woman with four children? So he knew there was no illusion about what the end result was going to be. On April 22nd, Richard Sharp returned to St. Paul and signed a statement implicating Anderson as the killer and saying that Mastrian offered him the job of killing Carol. Sheldon Morris surrendered to the police. On May 8th, a grand jury indicted Anderson and Mastrian. Morris was charged with accessory after the fact. On May 9th, a pair of bloody pants believed to have been worn by the killer were found in Sherburne County. On June 21st, Anderson gave a statement implicating T. Eugene Thompson, which led the police to arrest him. He was arrested on June 21st, 1963, at the house in Forest Lake. He was charged with first-degree murder. His bail was set at $100,000, which at the time was the highest in state history.
Well, that's a big chunk of change.
Well, we just mentioned how much $1 million really was in 1963. $100,000 bail in 1963. That is massive.
Yeah. It's a huge amount to try to cover.
You know, so based on the million, what would that be today? What do you think 100,000 would be today?
Oh, it's back then, today, 100,000, 750.
I think you're close. I think you're closer than your first one.
Yeah.
I was thinking a million, but I think 750 to a million. But it's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
For sure. Ramsey County Attorney William Randall said that the arrest was based on information given by Dick Anderson. And he knew it all. I mean, this is the guy who committed the murder.
Yeah.
He was privy to everything.
He knew exactly what happened.
The following statements come from court documents. Anderson testified in detail about the murder. He made another important statement in court saying, "This was the first time I had heard the name of Mr. Thompson." Mastrian said, "Mr. Thompson will leave the door open in the morning. You will be able to go inside and go down in the basement and wait. At 8:25, Mr. Thompson will call Mrs. Thompson. And at that time, you will be able to sneak up the stairway. Mrs. Thompson will be right around in the kitchen answering the telephone. The other telephones in the house will be removed so that she has no choice but to come downstairs." So again, going back to, you know, telephones being removed from rooms that are later found in Thompson's car. Here's the whole reason behind it.
Now we know.
Right? We only want one phone in the home. So it's that phone that has to be answered, which puts his wife in a certain place at a certain time. Anderson testified that we went over to the Highland Park area and he drove me past the residence at 1720 Hillcrest in the front. He said, "Look good at the front of the house." I did. And then we went around the alley and we made several trips around the alley and around the front of the home. Then we finally pulled up in front of the home. And then he showed me the side door, pointed it out to me, and said that there is no back door on the residence. He also said at 6 o'clock in the morning, there's no movement on the streets and there's no lights in this section. At that time, he took a rubber hose out from underneath the front seat of his car. And he told me that the woman should be hit at an angle across the back of the neck to more or less simulate falling in the bathtub. I asked him about the water in the bathtub, and he said, "Mr. Thompson will leave water in the tub." I discussed further with him about the body, whether it should be face down or face up if she fell in the bathtub. He said, "Be sure and have it so the body is up as far as the bathtub goes." And he instructed me as far as reverse artificial respiration on the chest.
So some pretty good details here.
Yeah, I think Anderson was very detailed in his testimony. He also testified that after he attacked Carol, he left out the front door and went to his apartment. He got a call from Mastrian. He put the clothes he wore into a bag, and he met Mastrian and Morris. They rode north of the Twin Cities and threw the clothes and the gun out of the car while driving down side roads. So like you said, very detailed, but also very damning, right, against Thompson for sure, but also Mastrian and some of the other people involved. T. Eugene Thompson's murder trial started on October 28th, 1963. The state presented evidence about the life insurance policies as well as affairs that T. had. The prosecution argued that Thompson arranged the murder so he could collect Carol's life insurance benefits. The New York Times reported that he had promised his former secretary that he would provide enough money for them to live on. Prosecutors argued that T. Eugene staged the call so he could say Carol was alive when he left for work. And I know this plan didn't work. And I always hate to say that something is kind of ingenious or smart in any way on the part of killers, but right, you would have to say that in theory, the plan was thought out.
Yeah, you would have to.
By Thompson.
Sure.
She would have been alive. When he left, he would have talked to her on the phone. How could he have had anything to do with her death,
right,
after the time of death was established and all that? And if everything would have gone according to plan, it most likely would have been ruled an accident anyway. Nobody would have been looking at anyone. Thompson's defense insisted that he was a loving husband who was accused by lying witnesses and besmirched by misleading evidence.
Ooh, besmirched.
I always love it when people use the word besmirch. You've besmirched my honor. And then you take your gloves off and you smack somebody in the face.
With the gloves?
With the gloves. Yeah. That's what they do in the movies.
Besmirched.
Thompson testified at trial, which, in many people's opinions, did more harm than good. That seems to happen more often than not.
Yeah, it's true.
He was found guilty of first-degree murder on December 6, 1963, and was immediately sentenced to life imprisonment at hard labor.
Nice.
Not just life in prison with no parole.
I like that part.
Sitting in a cell, life in prison at hard labor. So I'm picturing a little Cool Hand Luke action.
Yeah.
You know, the black and white stripes.
Yeah.
Using a pickaxe to break rocks, seemingly for no reason.
Nope.
And then let's pick up these big rocks and move them over here.
Yeah. Tomorrow, let's move them back.
And then tomorrow, we're going to move them back.
Yeah.
We're really not accomplishing anything, but you're going to work your ass off.
Right. Luke, why is that dirt on my ground?
I mean, I've got no problem with it.
Yeah.
Now, I think life in prison is what it is. Do some people care about it as much as others? Maybe not. You know, if you've got a TV and you're being provided three meals a day, I don't know that some people find it all that unpleasant, to be honest with you. Now, if you're in 95 degree weather, breaking big rocks into smaller rocks all day, maybe not as much fun.
I don't think you're going to like it.
Although I don't know how many inmates we want running around with pickaxes and things like that.
Well, they'd be chained up together.
Right? Yeah, they normally are, I think. I don't know. And there's usually, at least in the movies, there's guys on horses with guns and, you know. Everything for me goes back to movies because that's really all I know about.
I'm pretty sure Cool Hand Luke, they were on horses. Yeah. And
Maybe everything I know goes just to Cool Hand Luke.
Keep shaking that bush.
Exactly. On June 11th, 1964, Sheldon Morris pleaded guilty to accessory after the fact. He was sentenced to 5 years, but it was suspended with 5 years probation. On June 22nd, 1964, Dick Anderson changed his plea from innocent to guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. He was given credit for a year he had spent in the Ramsey County Jail, which I thought was strange in the research because, okay, it's life in prison. Maybe he got credit for when his parole would come up or what? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, if you got life in prison, you got life in prison. It's like, hey, thanks for that credit, but I don't ever get to use it, right?
Maybe instead of parole at 25 or 30, it'll be 24 or 29. I don't know. Thompson's appeal to the Supreme Court of Minnesota was decided on January 7th, 1966. The court affirmed his conviction. Carol's parents took custody of the children. Their son, Jeffrey, became a lawyer and eventually the Rice County attorney. He prosecuted several murder cases. And then in 1999, he was appointed a district court judge in Winona.
Good for him.
Yeah. Thompson did reestablish relationships with his children, sisters, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. Jeffrey Thompson originally visited his father in prison, and he asked for early parole. He said in an interview with the New York Times, it's very hard for a child to have a parent in prison, but once he got out, we never had much of a relationship. And he did get out. On March 15th, 1983, Thompson was approved for full parole. He'd been living in a halfway house for 3 months and participating in a work release program. Both Anderson and Mastrian were approved for similar work release programs. And they would qualify for full parole in 1983 as well. Anderson said he planned to move to Oregon. And Mastrian said he planned to write a book with a professor from Washington. So what do you think?
Didn't spend much time in there.
20 years, right? 20 years, give or take.
Yeah. I don't know why they call it life if it's not life.
Yeah, I understand life with the possibility of parole. I get that. But when you look at a husband, you know, taking out the policies, doing everything he did, it was so cold, it was so calculated, and, you know, killing his wife or having his wife killed, the mother of his children, is 20 years enough? And I think a lot of people would say no, because I get it. This happened in the 60s.
Sure.
You know, I keep going back to the war on drugs. People with like three strikes on marijuana spent like 25 years in prison.
Not longer.
They didn't kill anybody.
No. Now it's free most places.
I don't know about free, but legal.
You know what I mean? Legal. Yeah, okay. Legal. It's not free.
I don't know where you've been where they're just handing out marijuana.
No. It's definitely capitalized.
But, you know, it's so interesting to kind of look back through history and see what was prioritized and what wasn't, and what kind of sentences were handed out for, you know, different types of crimes. Thompson resettled in the Twin Cities, and he got married to a woman named Margaret Culver. As a convicted felon, obviously he was no longer able to practice law, and he remained on parole for the rest of his life. According to Jeff Thompson, his father supported himself through real estate. According to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, when author Bill Swanson asked T. Eugene how he made his money, he said, "Well, the market has been good to me." In 1986, 3 years after Thompson was released from prison, Jeff and two of his sisters had what they called a family showdown with their father. According to the Twin Cities Pioneer Press, Jeff said, "We sat down with him and gave him a chance to show us that he had been wrongly convicted. It was pretty clear during the course of that conversation that he wasn't going to be able to do that. After that, I didn't hear a whole lot of protests. I didn't bring it up again. I told him that if he wanted to admit and ask for an apology, I'd rethink my position on him. But otherwise, we were pretty much done. Yes, I'm convinced he was guilty. I have faith that the jury came to the right verdict. I have faith in our criminal justice system in the state of Minnesota. Still, after 40 years of involvement." So I thought this part was pretty interesting, right? This is about 3 years after he was released. And, you know, as the children, they're now grown, they're adults. They are interacting with a man convicted of engineering the murder of their mother. How's that going to go down?
I wouldn't think very good.
No. And they're basically saying, "Hey, show us that you didn't do it. Prove to us that you didn't do it." And obviously he can't, because he did do it.
Yeah, and that's why he's set in prison for all those years.
T. Eugene Thompson died on August 7, 2015 at his condo in Roseville. He was 88 years old. His paid obituary ran in the Pioneer Press and Star Tribune. There was no mention of the murder, which I can't imagine there would be. And I think anybody writing an obituary would probably leave that part out.
Of course, yeah. Well, at least you probably should.
You should.
Out of all the highlights, that's probably not the highlight you'd want in there.
Unless you really are upset with this person, you know. And he did die on his 88th birthday. Jeffrey Thompson told CBS that he didn't know much about his father's death. He said, "We were told that he was fading and that we needed to get up and see him if we were going to. Before I knew it, he was gone." And it sounds like, you know, really before his death, they had a very contentious relationship. They didn't talk all that much.
Yeah, it didn't seem like they were very close.
No, not at all. Now, one of the things that I really found fascinating, and this came out of the book by Bill Swanson, was he talked about the fact that the Thompson trial was covered across the country. It was a big case.
Yeah.
Right, that went out on UPI's national wire. But it was interrupted because on November 22nd, President John F. Kennedy was shot and killed. And you and I have done a number of stories that happened either the day after or in the months after 9/11.
Yes.
And I remember us talking about how they really didn't receive the type of coverage that they would have.
No, because of what happened.
And that obviously dominated the news cycle, as did the assassination of JFK. Many believe that this case is the inspiration for the 1996 movie Fargo. But filmmaker Joel Cohen said in an interview with the New York Times that the film is not based on the T. Eugene Thompson case, and that actually he had never heard of Thompson. Carol Thompson was murdered because of her husband's selfish desire for money. But Gibbs, she fought back against her killer. She escaped the house. And really, it was that effort that exposed her husband's murder for hire plot and ultimately led to the arrest of all those people. If it weren't for, you know, what Carol Thompson did, her bravery, her tenacity, it is entirely possible that her murder might have gone unsolved for a long time, might be unsolved today.
And all those individuals be out there free, never having spent any time in prison.
Yeah, it is entirely possible. But that's it for our episode on T. Eugene Thompson. We got some voicemails. You want to check those out?
Yeah, let's hear those.
Hi, guys. This is Ashley Beth from Chicago. So I've been binging TCAT for a few months now, but it's mostly when I sleep. And I got to say, Mike, you know, your voice is very soothing. It puts me right to sleep every time. Except last night, in my dream, I was giving a very important speech. And it was one of those dreams where you're like somewhat aware of the real world, but still dreaming. And I could remember being like, who is this talking during my speech? How dare you? So therefore, I'm Team Gibby. So stay safe. Keep your own time ticking.
Yeah, I never talk during someone's speech. I know how to respect that time up there on the podium.
So we have a lot of people who explain their reasoning behind being Team Gibby. This has got to be one of the stranger ones.
You're like, really? Because I was in your ear, you know, because you chose to listen to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I interrupted your speech. That's like the one where, and I think I've told you before, my wife sometimes wakes up from one of her dreams and she is so seething mad at me.
Right.
Because in the dream, I have cheated on her, but I'm in the bed. I'm right next to her.
I haven't left. I'm right here.
And she is so mad at me.
Yeah.
And sometimes the next day.
It takes a while to cool off.
Yeah. I'm like, you do know it was a dream, right?
She's like, don't touch me.
It was absolutely a dream.
Yeah, but you made a good choice being Team Gibby.
I'm not responsible for what happens in your dreams.
Hey, this is Patrick from Vermont calling. I just wanted to put my two cents in on a Gibbyism on the Dana Flynn episode. He used the word fictitious, and Fergie correctly, half correctly, I think, guessed that he was trying to say vindictive. I think he mixed it up with fictitious as well. Hence, fictitious. So put that one in the book of Gibbyisms. I'll keep keeping track. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Hey, this is Patrick from Vermont again. I just called. I got distracted unscrewing my Christmas tree from the base at the end of the last message. Notice I spaced out. What I meant to say was keep your own time ticking. All right, bye.
It's a thick book that I have.
Of Gibbyisms. Now, it's an interesting take. The problem is, I'm not sure you meant to say fictitious because it's not a word I've ever heard you use.
Yes.
Vindictive, I have heard. But again, I'm just guessing. Nobody really knows, including yourself, exactly what you're trying to say. So, you know, the Gibbyisms are up for debate. There's no doubt about it.
That could be its own podcast right there.
It could be.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of mailbag, you know, a lot of it probably Christmas related. Janice, I think it's Janice. It was a little hard to read and I tore off the return part. So send us a magnet from Lorain, Ohio, because in an episode we said we're not even sure where Lorain was. So
now we know.
She sent us a magnet.
Yeah.
Mallory sent Harley chips from Cancun.
Ooh, Cancun.
Yeah, which is very cool. She said there was actually a Harley store in the airport.
Really?
And that's where she got them.
Did it smell like sand and beaches?
She did not say.
Okay.
And then Betty Steele sent you what is probably a year's worth supply of red vines.
Yes.
And sent me some Black Rifle coffee. So very, very cool.
We're all set.
Yeah. We appreciate it very, very much.
I'm hyped up on
sugar.
On sugar now. You're hyped up on coffee.
Yeah. I'm always hyped up on coffee. But we appreciate all that very much. That's it, Gibbs. for another episode of True Crime All the Time. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
I want to tell everybody about a game that I've been playing recently called Two Dots. You know, primarily Two Dots is a puzzle-based game. You have to connect at least two dots of the same color to make a move. And then those connected dots are removed from the game area, and the dots above them drop down until they hit other dots or the floor beneath. But there's a variety of game modes. There's this really cool one called Scavenger Hunt, which is a really relaxing hidden object game. There's different levels to the game that are grouped into worlds, and it's very satisfying to move up. There's over 5,000 unique puzzles and fun levels, and with all the different gameplay modes, it really makes the gaming experience unique and exciting with every single puzzle. The visuals are amazing, and the in-game music I found to be very soothing. You can even challenge your friends on Facebook to make it competitive, link up, and see how your dot skills match up. And best of all, it's free to download, and you don't need Wi-Fi to play it. You can play it offline as well. Think you have what it takes to solve some fun puzzles? Download Two Dots now for free on Android or iOS.